not only since the last tide, but for a long time. But Weston, his eyes following his nose, saw fish drying.
There are boats around here somewhere.
There was a cantina. In the cantina were four tables, perhaps a dozen rickety chairs, and a bar onto which a metal Lucky Strike cigarette advertisement had been nailed. A shelf behind the bar held a dozen glasses and half a dozen empty Coca-Cola bottles. It was tended by a very fat Filipino woman with graying hair and bad teeth. She eyed them suspiciously. Weston looked at Everly, waiting for him to speak to the woman. After a moment, it became apparent that Everly was waiting for him to say something to her.
"Not because I'm the officer in charge, but because he doesn't want her to know he speaks Spanish. Christ, why didn't I think of that?"
Weston gestured that he wanted something to drink.
"No cerveza," the woman said.
Weston knew enough Spanish to understand there was no beer. He shrugged, hoping she would interpret this to mean he would be satisfied with whatever she had.
"Dinero?"
the old woman asked. He reached in his pocket and laid an American $5 bill on the bar. She picked it up, examined it carefully, laid it back down, and walked out of the cantina through a door in the rear. In 2 minutes, she was back with one bottle of Coca-Cola. She opened it and handed it to him. Then she picked up the $5 bill and stuffed it in the opening of her dress.
"It's a good thing we're not really thirsty," Everly said,
and then indicated with a barely perceptible move of his head that Weston should look behind him. A small, dark-skinned man had come into the cantina. He was barefoot, and he was wearing a loose-fitting cotton pullover shirt and baggy, ragged, cuffed trousers.
"Hello, American buddies," he called from behind the bar. "I speak English. How are you?"
"Hello," Weston said.
"Very bad," the Filipino said. "Goddamn, very bad."
"What's very bad?"
"Fucking war,"
the Filipino said, walking to Weston, putting out his hand, and when Weston took it, shaking it enthusiastically.
"Fucking Japan's bullshit."
"Very bad," Weston agreed.
"Hello, buddy,"
the Filipino said to Everly. Everly nodded his head.
"No fucking beer," the Filipino said. "Damn near no Coca-Cola. Fucking Japan's."
"Yes," Weston agreed.
"What can I do for you?"
the Filipino asked. "Actually, we're looking for a boat."
"No fucking boats anymore. You got any money?"
"We're trying to rent a boat to take us off Bataan," Weston said.
"No fucking boats. Japan's maybe 25 miles away. Next week, they'll be here."
"What happened to the boats that were here?" Weston asked.
"Bah, everybody gone, except maybe one or two boats hidden."
"We would like to rent one of the boats that are hidden," Weston said.
"Oh, very expensive, very illegal, very dangerous. Be very expensive."
"How expensive?"
"Very expensive. $1,000.
"How about 500? Everly said.
$1,000. No boats left. Fucking war. Fucking Japan's."
"All we have is $1,000,
Weston said, "and we'll need money when we get to Mindanao." The slight Filipino looked thoughtful.
"Why you want to go to Mindanao?"
"To fight the Japanese," Weston said.
"Oh, fucking Japan's no fucking good. Goddamn. I will ask, but I think man with boat will want $1,000.
"If you take us to Mindanao," Weston said, "I'll give you $1,000. $500 now, $500 when we get there."
"I will ask," the Filipino said. "You stay here. Drink Coca-Cola. I will come back."
"When I see the boat, I will give you $500, Weston said.
"You stay here. Drink Coca-Cola," the Filipino said. "I come quick."
He left the cantina the way he had come in.
"That was too easy," Everly said softly.
Weston's temper flared.
"You have any better ideas, Sergeant?" "You show, Mr. Weston, but if I was you, I'd put all but the $1,000 someplace he can't see it."
Weston glowered at him, which didn't seem to faze Everly at all.
If he does come back, I wouldn't give him the 500 until we're on the boat, Everly said.
The Filipino came back after 15 minutes, but he didn't enter the cantina. He stood in the door and motioned for them to follow him. Everly gestured for Weston to go first. The Filipino led them down a trail through the thick vegetation for a quarter mile, and then stopped. He pointed toward the water. After a moment, Weston saw faint marks on the muddy, rocky beach, which suggested that a boat had been dragged from the water. A moment later, he saw the stern of a boat peeking through the thick vegetation.
"Good fucking boat," the Filipino said. "Carry you to Mindanao. Shit, carry you to fucking Australia."
He left the trail and pushed his way through the vegetation toward the beach. When they reached the boat, two other Filipinos were there. An older man was dressed like the first, and a stocky, flat-faced young woman wore a thin cotton dress and apparently nothing else.
"They no speak English like me," the Filipino said. "I translate for you."
There was an exchange between the Filipino men.
"He say he want to see money."
"I'll give him the money when that boat is in the water and we're underway," Weston said.
"You not trust me?"
the Filipino asked in a hurt tone.
"When the boat is in the water and we've pushed off," Weston said.
"No go now,"
the Filipino said, as if explaining something to a backward child.
"Must go in dark. Fucking Japan see us if we go now, and maybe fucking U.S. Navy."
Weston wondered if that meant the Navy was patrolling these waters to prevent Americans from leaving the peninsula.
"From deserting in the face of the enemy."
He looked at his watch. It was 17:35. Darkness should fall soon.
"Okay,"
Weston said. "We'll wait."
"Okay,"
the Filipino said.
"Get off beach where nobody can see you."
As darkness fell, there was a heavy rain shower, and Weston and Everly found what shelter they could under the hull of the boat. It didn't offer much shelter, though, and they could not help but notice the battered condition of the hull. It was quite dark when other men appeared. Their Filipino motioned them out from under the hull, and when they moved onto the beach, they almost immediately stepped into water. The beach had narrowed. The tide had risen. The men, using ropes woven from vines, dragged the boat across the beach and got it into the water.
"You give me money now,"
their Filipino said when the boat was bobbing, barely visible, several yards offshore. When Weston produced the money, the Filipino counted it in the light of a Zippo lighter. The lighter had a USMC insignia. For a moment, Weston thought, lightly, that might be a good omen. Then he wondered where the Filipino found the lighter. Lighters were in short supply. There were no more ship stores or army post exchanges, nor stores outside military bases. Good cigarette lighters were in demand. People took care of them.
"Where did this guy get the lighter? Steal it from somebody? Offer some other Marine a way off Bataan, then rob him, knowing he couldn't go to the military police? Or throw him over the side? That's paranoid. There's no reason to be suspicious of the Filipino. If he'd wanted to rob us, he could have done it in the cantina, or while we were here in the bush waiting for it to get dark. And we couldn't have done a thing about it. There is a boat, and absolutely no indication that the Filipino was going to do anything but what he agreed to do. Get us off Bataan. What's wrong with you, Jim Weston, is that you're afraid. You're afraid of what you're doing, deserting in the face of the enemy, and you're afraid of getting killed. For Christ's sake, you're supposed to be an officer. Act like one."
They waded out to the boat, finding themselves in water almost to their armpits, holding their weapons over their heads. When they reached the side of the boat, one of the Filipinos leaned over and took Weston's Springfield from him. Then he reached down for the web belt with its holstered pistol.
"If I hand over the pistol, I'll be disarmed. Maybe they've been waiting for this, to separate us from our weapons. Ugh, for Christ's sake, stop it. If they wanted to slit our throats, they would have done that on the beach."
He let the Filipino on the boat take the web belt, and then a hand found his in the darkness, and he felt himself being hauled out of the water. The first thing that happened was his pistol belt and the Springfield were returned to him, which made him feel like a fool. Everly came aboard a moment later. One of the Filipino seamen took Weston's arm, led them to a small hatch in the deck, and motioned them through it. A match flared, and in its light, Weston saw the Filipino lighting a primitive oil lamp, nothing more than what looked like a 6-inch piece of clothesline stuck into a bottle of oil. But the flame caught, and the small compartment was dully illuminated. The Filipino handed him the lamp, and then left the compartment, closing the hatch after him. Weston looked at Everly.
"Well, we seem to be on our way," Weston said.
Everly did not reply. Weston saw Everly make sort of a pillow out of his rucksack and then lie down on the deck. Weston had no rucksack and tried to make himself comfortable without one, but the confinement of the compartment and the curve of the hull made this impossible. His head hung down painfully. Finally, he took off his shirt and rolled it up. This seemed to work. He heard creaking sounds from outside, and then he had a sense of motion, as if the boat were getting underway.
"Have you got a match or a lighter?"
Everly asked. It was the first time he had spoken.
"Both," Weston replied. "Why don't you put that lamp out?"
Everly said, his suggestion again sounding more like an order.
"If we need it, we can relight it. If that lamp spills lit, there's likely to be a fire."
"Right," Weston said, and blew the flame out. There was an unpleasant-smelling smoke, and the coal on the wick took a long time to die out. Then the darkness was complete. There was no question now that they were moving. The hull was canted, which forced Weston to readjust his position on the deck, and he could hear the splash and gurgle of water on the hull. He started to think. The idea that they were going to be robbed and killed no longer seemed credible. He was almost embarrassed that he had had it. But what was real was that he had now deserted. That was a fact. He had deserted in the face of the enemy, in the foul-smelling bilge of a crude Philippine fishing boat. It was not what he had had in mind when he joined the Corps and went through flight school. He fell asleep, trying to put things in order, telling himself he was going to have to stop dwelling on the desertion business. It wasn't as if he was running away to avoid his military duty. What he really was doing was evading capture so that he could make his way to Australia and get back in the cockpit of a fighter to wage war against the enemy as he had been trained to fight. Weston woke in shock and confusion. That immediately turned into terror. He tried to sit up, a reflex action, and became instantly aware that something, someone, was lying on him. And then whoever was lying on him was thrashing about and making horrible guttural sounds. And then, again, without conscious effort, when he tried to push whoever was on top of him off or to slip out from under him, he realized his hands were slippery.
"Mr. Weston, are you all right?"
Everly hissed. Before Weston could form a reply, he sensed movement, and then the weight on him lifted.
"What the hell? You all right?"
Everly asked again.
"Did he cut you?"
"Oh, Christ," Weston said. "What the hell happened?"
"I cut his throat,"
Everly said, almost matter-of-factly.
"Are you all right?"
"The son of a bitch is annoyed that I didn't answer him quickly enough."
"I'm wet. My hands are wet,"
Weston said. And then he realized what made his hands wet and sticky, and was quickly nauseous. Not much came out, but his chest hurt from the effort, and there was a foul taste of bile in his mouth.
"What the hell happened?"
he asked, now indignant himself.
"Here it is," Everly said. "I found it."
"Found what?"
"The knife. A fillet knife, it looks like,"
Everly said. Weston felt something pushing at him.
"You take it."
"I don't want it."
"There's 3 more of them outside," Weston said. "In 30 seconds, they're gonna suspect this guy fucked up."
"He tried to kill me?"
Weston asked, his brain not quite willing to accept that fact.
"Just be glad he went after you first," Everly said. "If I'd have had to fight the son of a bitch, no telling what would have happened."
"Jesus Christ."
"Load your pistol,"
Everly ordered.
"There's blood all over my hands.
Wipe them, for Christ's sake, on your pants. Get your pistol loaded. Quietly.
Weston slapped his hands against his trousers to wipe off the blood, then somehow managed to get the .45 pistol from its holster. The first time he tried to pull the slide back to chamber a cartridge, his fingers slipped when it was halfway back, and the spring forced the slide forward again without chambering a cartridge.
Quietly, for Christ's sake,
Everly said. And then, as a flashlight played in the compartment, blinding Weston with its sudden light, he added,
Shit!
A moment later, there were half a dozen deafening explosions, each accompanied by an orange flash. Now everything seemed to move in slow motion. Weston frantically wiped his fingers on his trousers and felt for the serrations on the rear of the pistol slide. He jerked it back violently. His fingers slipped off, but when the slide moved forward again, he heard and felt a cartridge being chambered. He now recognized the noise. It was the Thompson firing, and it was incredibly loud, painfully deafening. His ears rang, and he felt dizzy. Though he was nearly blinded by the light from the flashlight, he vaguely saw Everly diving for it. Then he covered it with his body, and the light went out. An orange ball in Weston's eyes faded slowly. After what seemed like a full minute, but was probably far less time, he could make out a slightly lighter area in the blackness. This was the hatch to the compartment, he realized, now open. A moment later, he saw the reason the hatch was open. There was a body in it. He could now make out Everly, not clearly, but clearly enough to see that he was grasping the hair on the head of the body in the hatch. He pulled the head back and cut the man's throat.
They don't have any weapons, Everly said. Guns. If they did, they would have used them by now. But how the fuck did we get out of here?
They'll be waiting for us, Weston said, and immediately felt like a fool.
Everly moved close to the hatch, then rolled onto his back.
As soon as I'm through the hatch, you follow, Everly ordered. Come up here.
Weston moved toward the hatch. When he put his hand to the deck, it slid in what had to be blood. The bile returned to his mouth, but he was able to restrain the impulse to vomit. He had just reached Everly when Everly fired the Thompson at the side and overhead bulkheads, 10 or 12 rounds in 2- and 3-round bursts. The noise and muzzle flashes were again blinding, deafening, and painful. When partial sight returned, Weston could see Everly shoving himself through the hatch, still on his back. Additional flashes came from the Thompson, but with the muzzle outside the compartment, no more painful explosions assaulted his ear. Weston dove through the hatch the moment Everly had cleared it, then rolled onto his back.
Shoot the son of a bitch!
Everly ordered. Weston looked frantically from side to side and finally saw one of the Filipinos scurrying aft on all fours.
Shoot the son of a bitch!
Everly screamed. Weston held the Colt in both hands, lined up the sights as best he could, and fired. The Filipino seemed to hesitate. Weston shot him again, and again.
Make sure he's dead, Everly called, somewhat more calmly.
Weston rose to his feet and walked unsteadily aft. The Filipino, he was there, Filipino, the one who'd arranged for the boat, taken the money, was on his stomach, his legs pushing as if trying to get away. Weston did not want to shoot him again. But then, as if with a mind of its own, the hand holding the .45 raised the pistol until it was pointing at the base of the man's skull, and his finger pulled the trigger. The man's head seemed to explode. He looked back at Everly in time to see him, far more clearly this time, repeat what he'd done in the compartment. Pulling the man's head backward by his hair to expose his throat, he used a thin-bladed knife to cut deeply into it. Blood gushed out. Everly dropped the man's head onto the deck. As Weston watched, horrified, Everly ran his hands over the man's body, searching it. He put his hands in the man's pockets and came out with a pocket watch, a key, and some money, all of which he jammed into his own pocket. Finally, he stood up.
You want to give me a hand here, Mr. Weston? What? Get this son of a bitch over the side, him and the others. You're going to throw him overboard? You want to keep them, Mr. Weston?
Everly asked. Weston went forward and helped Everly throw the body over the rail. It entered without much of a splash, and when he gave in to the impulse to look over the side, it was nowhere in sight. Everly was by then already aft, searching the body of their Filipino. From it, he took a canvas wallet and a gold locket of some sort the man had been wearing around his neck. He went into the wallet and took from it the $500 Weston had given the man on the beach. He put the money in his pocket, and then, horrifying Weston, he pulled the man's trousers off. Everly met his eyes.
"We're gonna need clothes," he said, adding, "Help me get the bastard over the side."
Weston moved to help him. The body fell backward into the water, and Weston had a quick sight of the man's face, the features obscenely distorted by the .45 bullet. It would remain with him for a long time. By the time they dragged the last two bodies from the compartment, searched them, stripped them, and pushed them over the side, Weston was exhausted, sweating, and breathing heavily. He sat down on the deck, his back against the mast, feeling sick and fighting the urge to throw up. A few minutes later, Everly came back and sat down beside him.
"No food and no charts," Everly said. "Those bastards had no intention of doing anything but going back where we came from, with our money and without us."
"Shit," Weston said.
After a while, he became aware that his hands were sticky. He knew why. He pushed himself away from the mast and made his way aft, knelt on the deck, and put his hands in the water. There was no sensation of movement other than a side-to-side rocking motion. He washed his hands and arms as well as he could and tried not to think what his chest must look like. Then he pulled himself back in the boat and brushed up against something hard, which moved. After a moment, he realized it was the tiller. There was no life to it, which confirmed his belief that they were sitting dead in the water.
"If that's the case, the bodies we put over the side are likely to be floating around right next to us. We have to get out of here. Where the hell are we?"
The flashlight came on, and Everly directed it at the mast. The sail was down, which explained why they were dead in the water. The light went out. After a moment, there was a creaking sound, and Weston sensed, rather than saw, that Everly was raising the sail. Confirmation of this came a moment later when he heard the sound of the sail filling. A moment later, he felt a faint suggestion of movement. He put his hand to the tiller, put it amidship, and felt life come into it. Everly came aft. The flashlight came on, and he saw Everly studying a compass.
"We're pointing north," Everly said. "We want to go southeast. You know anything about sailing a boat, Mr. Weston?"
"Only what I learned at camp when I was a kid."
"Can you turn us around, point us southeast?"
"Where are we going?"
"Mindanao," Everly said. "It's 500 miles or so to the southeast."
"We don't have any food or any water," Weston said.
"There's a bunch of little islands between here and Mindanao. We'll just have to try to get food and water."
"I'll bring us about," Weston said. "Watch the boom, and I think you better give me that compass."
Everly handed him the compass. Weston started pushing on the tiller. The boat began to turn.
"Yeah, at least we got our money back," Everly said. "That's something."
"And our lives. We're alive," Weston thought, but said nothing.
"Plus what looked like another 300-400, Everly added. "I don't think we were the first people these fuckers took for a boat ride."
3. When the sun came up, they were out of sight of land, alone on a gently rolling sea. Everly's Marine Corps issue compass showed them on a southeasterly course. Weston wondered if that were actually the case, or whether steel or iron somewhere on the boat was attracting the compass needle. On the other hand, they were not headed in the wrong direction. If the sun rises in the east and you are headed directly for it, then south is 90 degrees to the right. Since he was steering somewhat to the right of the rising sun, east and south, in other words, steering southeast, and this corresponded to the compass indications, they were probably headed on a generally southeastern course. But they weren't navigating. For the moment, of course, that was a moot point, since navigation presumes a destination, and they didn't know where they were going, except in the most imprecise terms, to Mindanao. Everly searched the boat as soon as there was enough light for that, but found nothing of value except 2 cans of pineapple slices and a bottle of Coca-Cola. No charts, no other food, and no water. He found a bucket, too, and used it to flush the blood from the deck. But cleaning up the compartment where they were hiding, where the Filipinos tried to kill them, was impossible. He could have poured water into the compartment, but there was no way to pump it out. When a sickly, sweet smell began to come from below, Everly closed the hatch, and they tried to ignore the odor. They shared the Coca-Cola and the 2 cans of pineapple slices. Weston thought that perhaps it wasn't wise to eat all the pineapple at once. Maybe they should have saved half for later. Then he decided it didn't make any difference. They had to find more food and water, or they were finished. By 10 in the morning, the heat from the sun grew uncomfortable. Using a foul-smelling piece of worn canvas, they rigged an effective sunshade. But that was too late. They were already badly sunburned. A few minutes after 3 in the afternoon, they saw on their left horizon what could be land. The question was, if it was land, and not their eyes just playing tricks on them, what was it? It very easily could have been part of the island of Luzon, the far side of the entrance to Manila Bay. The Japanese were supposed to be all over that part of Luzon. Was that true? Was it worth it to go through everything they'd gone through just to find themselves prisoners of the Japanese, even before that would have happened if they'd stayed on the rock instead of deserting in the face of the enemy? But the alternative to making for what was probably land on the horizon, Weston decided, was to continue on a course he had very little confidence in, and without food and water. For all he knew, if he kept on his present course, he could very easily be heading out into the South China Sea, with no landfall possible until long after they were dead of dehydration. 20 minutes later, they could see enough to know that it was indeed land on the horizon. A half hour after that, they were close enough to make out surf crashing against a solid wall of vegetation. There was no sign of civilization. It was now getting close to 5 p.m.
"We don't have an anchor, and we can't get through that surf," Weston said. "Go to the left. Maybe we'll find something," Everly replied.
As they approached the beach, the western end seemed to recede and then disappear.
"What is this?" Weston asked. "I think we got a little fucking island," Everly said, pleased.
"Holding 2 reserve divisions of the Imperial Japanese Army," Weston replied. Everly looked at him with genuine concern in his eyes.
"Why would you say that, Mr. Weston?" he asked.
"I was making a joke."
"Oh."
The sun was low on the horizon when they finally saw a break in the surf. As they approached it, Weston saw that it was a passage between a very small island and the first island they'd found. There was still no sign of human life, and the only sounds were the distant rustle of the surf and the waves splashing against the bow of the boat. The war that they had so recently left on Corregidor and Bataan, the smells of burned fuel and supplies, the never-ending muted roar of cannon, the dull crump of explosions, could have been happening at another time on a distant planet. As they entered the passage between the islands, Weston saw a small beach on the larger island. There was no surf.
"We could try to put in there," he said,
as much to himself as to Everly.
"I don't know how shallow it is. We're likely to go aground." "Do we have any choice, Mr. Weston?"
Weston steered for the small beach. They made it all the way to the shore without scraping bottom. As Everly leapt ashore carrying a rope with him, Weston decided the current flowing through the passage had scoured it clean of sand. Tying the boat up was no problem. Trees and thick vegetation came right down to the water. Everly looped the line around a thick, twisted tree trunk. The current pulled the boat against what Weston presumed was the solid rock of the shoreline.
"What's going to happen now is that the current is going to batter the hull against the rocks, whereupon we will sink."
That didn't happen. The current simply held the hull against the rocks with little movement. Everly heaved himself back aboard.
It's a goddamned hill starting right at the trees, he said. I don't think I could climb it even if it wasn't dark. We'll have to see what happens in the morning.
There's supposed to be feral hogs on these islands, Weston said.
What?
Wild pigs. Maybe we could shoot one.
Everly's silence made it clear he didn't think that was likely.
You want to do 2-hour watches? He asked. Fine. You want to go first or me?
I'll go first, Weston said.
Everly made himself a pillow from some of the clothing he had removed from the bodies, covered himself with the rest, and went to sleep. In 10 minutes, it was so dark Weston had difficulty seeing him. He sat immobile for perhaps 10 minutes, listening to unidentifiable sounds coming from the shore, and then, without thinking about it, he scratched his chest. His skivvy shirt was covered with drying blood. On all fours, he crawled on the deck, carefully avoiding Everly, until he found the bucket. Then he crawled aft again and stripped. First, he carefully rinsed his skivvy shirt and drawers in the water and arranged them on the rail to dry. Then he dipped the bucket into the water, held it over his head, and poured it over his body. He did this a dozen times. The dried blood had matted his hair together and didn't want to dissolve, until he was sure he was as clean as he was going to get. Still naked, he sat down with his legs folded under him. He looked at his watch. The luminous hands told him it was 8:05. He wondered how long it had taken him to find the bucket, do his laundry, and bathe.
Fuck it. I'll count 2 hours from now. From 8. I'll wake Everly at 10.
He sat there in the dark, his knee touching the web belt with the .45 in its holster, remembering with sudden clarity how the watch had looked when he'd brought it home from the officer's sales store at Pensacola. It was a Hamilton chronograph, stainless steel. By pressing the appropriate button, he could mark elapsed time of his choice. Length of flight. 1 minute, 360-degree turn. Whatever. It came in a metal box with a spring-loaded cover. It had an alligator strap, and there was a little book of instructions. He wanted one from the moment he first saw it, but it was considered pushy for students to wear one until they had completed primary flight and soloed and stood a reasonable chance to win their wings of gold. He remembered very clearly the first time he strapped it to his wrist. On another planet. At another time. When he was a naval aviator. When Weston opened his eyes, Everly, naked, was squatting beside him. It was light. Weston was confused. It shouldn't be light. He woke Everly at 10. Everly, therefore, should have waked him at midnight. At midnight, it was still dark.
What's up?
I didn't hear a fucking thing for 2 hours, Everly said. So I figured, fuck it, why wake you up? And I went to sleep.
Oh.
And look what I see when I do wake up, Everly said and pointed.
Weston sat up. 200 yards offshore was a cabin cruiser.
Adrift. Not under power.
Can you get us over there?
I don't know. I can try.
It's a long way to swim, and there's sharks, I hear, in these waters. Let's get the sail up and we'll see what happens.
Neither put into words what both thought. There was a chance the cabin cruiser would have food aboard, and a compass, and God only knows what else.
What's it doing here? Adrift.
It took them nearly an hour to reach the boat. There was almost no wind, and the current moved both vessels through the passage and into open water as they pursued it. As they drew closer, they became aware of the sweet stench of corrupting bodies, and then of a horde of flies. The boat looked like a Chriscraft 42, but there was no Chriscraft insignia. Probably, Weston decided, a local manufactured boat using a Chriscraft as a pattern. Her tailboard read, "Yet Again, Manila," and a faded Manila Yacht Club pennant flew from her rigging. The stench grew worse as they approached her. When they were at her stern, it was nearly overwhelming. Everly finally managed to get a hand on her, pulled himself aboard, and then threw Weston a line. The moment he saw Weston had grabbed it, he went to the side rail and threw up. The line was new, still white. Weston made the boat fast to the cruiser and then jumped aboard. There was evidence that the cruiser had been machine-gunned, probably strafed. He saw bullet holes in the deck, in the bulkheads, and in the glasswork. The ignition key was in the on position. The fuel gauges showed empty, but Weston pressed the engine start button anyway. The engines turned over, but there was no fuel, and they didn't start. The flies started to bite. There was nothing he could do about them. Everly came out of the galley carrying cases of canned food.
"It's even beer," he said. "Oh, fucking flies are eating me alive."
"I wonder what happened."
"Who the fuck knows? What I think we should do is stack everything there by the stern, and then I'll go on the boat and you hand it to me."
They made half a dozen trips into the galley before Weston found the courage to ask the question that was in his mind even before they had come aboard.
"What happened to the people who were on here?"
"If they were alive, they would have come out by now," Everly said.
Weston went into the galley again, and then, forcing himself, he went through it into the passageway leading to the cabins. He could not restrain the urge to vomit. When he had stopped heaving, he had difficulty resisting the urge to flee. But he went into the master cabin. He found two bodies. A gray-haired woman was on the double bunk, her hands folded on her stomach. She was wearing shorts and a knit shirt. The shirt was thick with blood, the blood covered with swarms of flies. She had been shot in the chest. The second body was lying on the deck next to the bunk, a man in his 50s. He had shot himself in the temple. A snub-barreled revolver was on the deck beside him. Weston took a quick look around and fled the cabin.
"Well?"
Everly asked when Weston was back on deck.
"There's a couple back there. It looks as if the woman was killed and then the man shot himself.
Anything we can use?"
"I didn't look."
Everly gave him a look of contempt and headed for the cabin. Weston sat down on a cushioned seat against the stern rail and supported his head in his left hand, using the right to wave away the swarming flies. Everly reappeared carrying blankets. Weston saw that he had the snub-nosed pistol jammed in his waistband, and that he, too, now had a first-class wristwatch. Weston had seen it on the man's body.
"I also found a bunch of good fucking charts," Everly said.
"What do you think we should do about the boat?"
"What do you mean, do about it?
Burn it, maybe?
And call attention to ourselves? The Japs already strafed this boat once. Those were machine gun bullets in the woman."
He indicated the bullet holes in the deck and glass.
"We can't just leave them in there like that," Weston said.
"Yes, we can," Everly said. "We load this stuff on the boat and get the fuck away from here before some other Jap airplane comes this way."
Weston felt anger well up within him so quickly and so fiercely that he was frightened. He forced himself, literally, to count to 10 before he spoke.
"Sergeant, find something to weight the bodies down. Maybe an engine battery. We'll wrap them in blankets and put them over the side." "Didn't you hear what I said, Mr. Weston, about getting out of here before the Japs come back? Didn't you hear what I said, Sergeant, about finding something to weight the bodies down?"
Everly met Weston's eyes for a long moment.
"The proper response, Sergeant, is aye, aye, sir."
There was another hesitation, shorter but perceptible.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Sergeant Everly said.
"Where's the charts you said you found?" Weston asked. "I want a quick look at them."
"Over there, Mr. Weston," Everly said, pointing to what looked like a brand new briefcase. "We also have another $3,000.
"You found a wallet or something?"
"Yes, sir."
"Names of these people in it?"
"I guess they're names."
"Don't lose it," Weston ordered. "Someone will want to know what happened to these people."
Like when we get to Australia, or when we win the war, Weston said curtly. Everly smiled. Something funny, Sergeant? Weston said as he felt his temper rise again. Then his mouth ran away with him. When I was in the officer's basic course, Everly, I had an instructor, a man like you. As a matter of fact, I recall him mentioning that he was an old China Marine. You know what he told me a Marine was? He said that a Marine was somebody hired by the government to take bullets for civilians. And that's what we're going to do. We're Marines, and we're going to bury these civilians. If we take a bullet while we're doing it, that's how it will have to be. Everly continued to smile. You think that's funny? Weston snapped. No, sir. What I was thinking. Out with it, Sergeant. Then maybe you're not the candy ass I thought you were at first. Well, fuck you, Sergeant, Weston heard himself say. Yes, sir, Everly said. I'll go see if I can find some batteries or something. As Everly said, the charts were good. Within a minute or so, Weston was sure he had found where they were, in the passage between Lubang Island and Ambil Island to its east. According to the chart, Ambil was uninhabited. To the south, across the Verde Island passage, was Mindoro. Now that he had the charts, presuming the boat didn't come apart on them, or Japanese aircraft didn't strafe them, or Japanese vessels didn't intercept them, or, for that matter, they didn't founder in one of the sudden, violent storms for which these seas were famous, he saw a good chance of making it through the inland Sibuyan Sea and then the Visayan Sea past the Visayan Islands, Panay, Negros, Cebu, and Bohol, into the Mindanao Sea and to Mindanao. There was a waterman pen and pencil set in the briefcase. He used the pencil to mark a tentative course, aware, but pretending not to notice, that Everly had brought the bodies onto the deck and trussed them neatly in blankets. Each of them was weighted down with two batteries. Everly found that a portion of the aft rail of the cruiser could be opened inward. He opened it.
"Anytime you're ready, Mr. Weston," he said.
"I think a word of prayer would be in order, Sergeant," Weston said, as he replaced the charts in the briefcase. Having said that, the only thing he could think of was the Lord's Prayer. He recited it as Everly stood with his head bowed. His mind then went blank. After a long moment, he said,
"Into the deep we commit the bodies of our brother and sister departed. Amen."
"Amen," Sergeant Everly parroted. They pushed the blanket-wrapped bodies through the opening in the rail into the sea. 30 minutes later, they cut loose from the yet again, and Weston pointed the bow toward the Verde Island passage. He looked back once at the cabin cruiser drifting on the blue water, and was sorry he did. 4. Headquarters, 4th Marine Regiment, Fortress Corregidor, Manila Bay, Republic of the Philippines, 0415 hours, 6 May, 1942.
"You know what I know about burning the colors, Paulson?"
Colonel S.L. Howard, USMC, who was the senior Marine officer on Corregidor, asked of Major Stephen J. Paulson, USMC, who was acting S-1, 4th Marines.
"No, sir."
They were perhaps 100 feet in a lateral tunnel opening off the main Malinta tunnel. From their lateral, it was perhaps 200 yards to the now sandbagged entrance. The colors, the national flag, and the regimental flag of the 4th Marines were behind Howard's desk, unfurled, their staffs resting in holders.
"Not very much," Howard said. "And I can't even remember where I learned. I must have read it somewhere in a novel. What I do know, I know that it is a disgrace to lose your colors to the enemy. And at the last possible moment before the enemy is to lay his hands on them, it is the duty of the senior officer present to burn them."
"That's how I understand it, sir."
"I would say we are at that moment, Paulson. Wouldn't you?"
"Yes, sir." There was no question about that. 2 days before, the Japanese assault on Fortress Corregidor had begun with a massive, unceasing, around-the-clock artillery barrage.
Someone had calculated that 11 explosive rounds were landing on the fortress every minute. That translated to 667 rounds per hour, 16,000 rounds each 24 hours. The Japanese landed on the island the day before at what was called the Tail of the Tadpole and suffered heavy losses. But they kept coming, and it was impossible to throw them back into the sea. To avoid firing on their own men, that portion of the Japanese artillery fire initially directed at the Tail of the Tadpole had shifted and was now falling on topside, the head of the Tadpole, where the barracks had once stood, and beneath which was the tunnel complex. Japanese infantry was making its way up from the tail to topside, slowly but irresistibly. There were approximately 15,000 American and Filipino men and officers defending Fortress Corregidor, very few of whom, approximately one-tenth, had training as infantry soldiers. The vast bulk of American military personnel, except for the regular Corregidor garrison, coast artillerymen, were technicians, staff officers, and clerks of one kind or another who had moved to Corregidor when General MacArthur had moved his headquarters to the fortress early in the war. Several hundred of the 1,500 military personnel trained as infantrymen were Marines. The vast bulk of these Marines were members of the 4th Marines, which had come to the Philippines from Shanghai in November 1941, had participated in action against the Japanese on Luzon, on the Bataan Peninsula, and had been ordered to Corregidor. There were also some Marines who had been stationed prior to the war at various U.S. Navy installations in the Philippines, then ordered to Corregidor. The coast artillerymen of the Corregidor garrison had done their job, and more than could have been reasonably expected of them. There was ample ammunition for their disappearing rifles, which were coast artillery cannon that rose on their carriages to fire and then lowered into a protected position, and for their enormous mortars, and it had been a rare moment in recent days when the roar of American cannon could not be heard or the concussion of their firing not felt. But it was not enough to stop the Japanese, and one by one, many of the guns and the gun positions previously believed impregnable had been destroyed. The clerks and technicians, pressed into service as riflemen, had done their duty too, performing it, in the private opinions of many Marines, far better than expected. But everybody was weak. They had been on half rations for more than 6 weeks, and half rations had recently been halved again. And exhausted. And they suffered from the ceaseless concussion of incoming Japanese artillery.
Somehow, I don't like the idea of burning them in here. We could carry them outside, sir. Could that be a signal that it's over?
Colonel Howard asked rhetorically, and then, without giving Paulson a chance to respond, changed the subject.
I took a look at the records yesterday, before ordering them burned, he said. The personnel rosters? We seem to be carrying an extraordinary number, even under these circumstances of personnel missing in action.
Yes, sir.
You would know more about this than I would, Major. Would you say some of the missing personnel went...
How do I say this?
Went missing, purposely.
If you're asking if there's been an attempt to avoid hazardous service, sir, I would say no.
Would you say then, Major, that some of those Marines, those now-burned reports carried as missing, absented themselves in the belief that they would thus be able to continue waging war against the Japanese in some other location?
I believe that is entirely possible, sir.
And how many of those who went purposely missing would you think made it through the enemy lines to some place where they could indeed continue to fight?
Major Paulson had a sudden, clear mental picture of two Marines, First Lieutenant James B. Weston and Sergeant Percy Lewis Everly.
There's no way of knowing, sir. Some obviously will have made it, and some obviously will have been killed or captured. Purposely absenting oneself, purposely going missing ordinarily would be something disgraceful. At the very least, even with the best intentions, it could be considered AWOL. At the worst, desertion in the face of the enemy.
Yes, sir.
Right now, Paulson, if I had the opportunity, I think I would go over the hill myself, burning the colors, hoisting the white flag.
I thought about it, sir, Paulson said.
But you stayed.
Disobeying an order is hard for me, sir.
And for me, Howard said. Yeah, how would you propose we do this, Paulson?
I've got something, Paulson said, and produced a quart-sized tin can. I don't know what it is. It's to clean a mimeograph machine, but it's highly combustible. I suggest, sir, that we pour it on the colors and ignite it. I'll hold the staffs, if you like, or...
There's enough for both the regimental and national colors?
Yes, sir.
And they're silk, sir. Once they're ignited, they'll burn. I don't want to do it in here, in this goddamn tunnel, like a trapped rat, Colonel Howard said. Would you be willing, Major Paulson, to go with me to the main tunnel entrance?
Yes, sir.
Of course, sir.
Colonel Howard nodded. He stood up and went to the two flags behind his desk. He took the national colors from its holder, held it horizontally, and then twisted the staff until the flag was wrapped around the pole. He handed the furled colors to Paulson. Then he repeated the furling action with the red regimental flag of the 4th Marines. When he was finished, he preceded Paulson down the lateral tunnel and then down the main tunnel to the entrance. As they approached the entrance, they could now hear small arms fire, the solid crack of American 30-06 caliber rifle and light machine gun fire, and the higher-pitched crack of Japanese small arms. They made their way past the sandbags. A Japanese artillery shell whistled in and exploded with a crash that made them both cringe.
The national colors first, I think, Paulson, Howard said. They are never supposed to touch the ground.
Aye, aye, sir, Major Paulson said. He held his flagstaff horizontally and twisted the staff so that the flag unwrapped from the staff. Colonel Howard leaned the colors of the 4th Marines against the sandbags, took Paulson's quart can of mimeograph machine cleaning fluid, and carefully poured half on the national colors. When he tried to ignite it with his Zippo cigarette lighter, it didn't work, and he had to dip into Paulson's pocket for Paulson's Zippo. The cleaning fluid ignited immediately, quickly igniting the silk material of the flag. But it took longer for the flag to burn than either Colonel Howard or Major Paulson expected. By the time it did burn, the flagstaff was smoldering, and here and there were other small flickers of flame. Paulson swung the flagstaff like a baseball bat against a concrete abutment, breaking it into two pieces. He picked up the top half with the gold-plated American Eagle and smashed the eagle against the concrete. Then he picked up the regimental colors of the 4th Marines, twisted the staff until the flag was unwrapped, and held it out for Colonel Howard to douse with mimeograph cleaning fluid and ignite. When the colors had burned, he smashed the staff, this time ruining the gold American Eagle first, and then breaking the staff. After that, Colonel Howard and Major Paulson went back into Malinta Tunnel. All other duties assigned to them having been performed, they then picked up their rifles and exited the tunnel to fight as infantry.
Part 4. 1. Jingug Bay, Misamis Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 0425 hours, 8 October 1942. The military force that its commander privately thought of as Weston's weary would-be warriors made landfall from Bohol Island at daylight. The commanding officer, First Lieutenant James B. Weston, USMC, in addition to a full beard, wore a wide-brimmed straw hat and a baggy pair of white cotton pants. He was barefoot and bare-chested, and his skin was deeply tanned. In addition to Sergeant Percy Lewis Everly, USMC, the force consisted of 12 other servicemen. Senior among them was Chief Pharmacist's Mate Stanley J. Miller, USN, who, with Seaman First Class Paul K. Nesbitt, had been the first recruits to the unit. For 2 weeks after leaving the yet again adrift off Lubang Island, Weston and Everly had traveled very slowly and very cautiously, sailing for 3 or 4 hours a day and spending the rest hiding. On the afternoon of the 15th day, they had come across the chief and Nesbitt in the Sibuyan Sea, drifting in a demasted sailboat. They had left Luzon with the same intention as Weston and Everly, making it to Mindanao and possibly to Australia, meanwhile avoiding capture by the Japanese. They took them aboard, scuttled their boat, fed them from their dwindling stocks of canned foods from the yet again, and resumed their painfully slow voyage toward Mindanao. It took them 6 months, by far most of it spent on one small island or another, trying to stay alive and out of the hands of the Japanese. On the island of Panay, while moving through the hills in search of food, they encountered a group of 5 Army Air Corps enlisted men, under Sergeant Alan F. Taylor. Taylor had been sent to search for possible auxiliary landing fields under the command of an Air Corps lieutenant colonel, who had surrendered to the Japanese at his first opportunity, telling his command they could do what they wanted. In the circumstances, it was every man for himself. None of the enlisted men had been willing to surrender. They placed themselves under Weston's command with the understanding that it was their intention to make it to Australia, and that they had no intention of trying to wage a guerrilla war against the Japanese. The force grew 2 months later on the island of Cebu by the addition of a sailor and a corporal. The corporal had been one of the few American enlisted men assigned to the 26th Cavalry, which had American officers and Filipino troopers. On Luzon, they had decided that between them they had the skills. The sailor knew how to handle a small boat, and the cavalryman, a veterinarian's assistant, knew how to speak Spanish, to make it to Mindanao and possibly out of the Philippine Islands. The last 3 recruits were Marines, old China Marines, career privates of the 4th Marines who had been captured and made a valiant effort to escape. Like Sergeant Everly, they were familiar with the practice of the Japanese Army to bayonet their prisoners when feeding or guarding them became a problem, or simply because it seemed like an interesting idea at the time. Everly knew 2 of the 3. He told Weston that one was a world-class drunk and the other had a room-temperature IQ, but was tolerated in the 4th Marines in Shanghai because when he turned out for guard mount, he looked like the pictures in the manual. The 3rd had been a clerk in the S-4 supply office, who was pressed into duty as a rifleman just before the 4th Marines were committed to battle for the first time.
"But don't worry, Mr. Weston. I can handle them. They're Marines."
The 26th Cavalry Corporal had an Enfield rifle and 23 rounds of .30-06 ammunition. The Air Corps contingent had 3 Enfields, 60 rounds of ammunition for them, and a .45 Colt 1911 A1 pistol with 12 rounds. The Marines had no firearms whatever, but had picked up 2 machetes and an axe. The money was just about gone. The $5,000 Weston had begun with, plus the $400 Everly had taken from the murderous Filipinos on the boat, plus the $3,000 they had taken from the yet again. The price of anything was what the market would bear, and simply to have enough simple food to stay alive, rice, fruits, and a rare pig or fresh ham, had been very costly. The notion of getting out of the Philippines to Australia now seemed unreal, and Weston privately thought that when they got to Mindanao, it wouldn't be very different from any of the other islands they'd been to. There would be no organized military force to which they could attach themselves. If they found any Americans at all, they would almost certainly be just like themselves, desperately dreaming of getting to Australia, but with no real hope of doing so. They had come to Mindanao because there was no place else to go, and because word had come to them on the grapevine that the Japanese were about to sweep Bohol Island and round up Americans once and for all. On making port, most of Weston's weary would-be warriors spent most of the day concealing their 2 boats, while a reconnaissance party consisting of Sergeant Everly, 2 of the 3 Marines, and 1 of the Air Corps PFCs investigated the area. When they did not return by nightfall, as Weston had ordered them to, he thought they had probably encountered Japanese. But he wasn't particularly concerned. They had,
if nothing else, acquired a demonstrated skill in hiding from Japanese. If they didn't return that night, they'd be back first thing in the morning. If they had actually gotten into a firefight with the Japanese, it was unlikely that all of them would have been killed or captured. In case there was a disaster, the standing order was for whoever came through the encounter alive to return to headquarters and warn the others. No one came to Jingoog Bay that night, or during the day, or during the next night, and Weston went to sleep about midnight, wondering if the ultimate disaster had happened, that everyone had been killed, or, worse for him and the men with him, captured. Given a few hours, the Japanese could force any information a prisoner had out of him. At that moment, the Japanese could be staging an operation to surround him and to make sure that no one slipped out to sea. At daylight, after Weston decided no one was going to come at first light either, he tried to decide whether to lead a second reconnaissance patrol, leaving Chief Miller in command, or to send Chief Miller on the patrol. The chief might be a marvelous pharmacist, but he was not a great leader of men. The only thing the chief would probably be worse at than commanding the unit would be leading a reconnaissance patrol. On top of all that, Sergeant Alan F. Taylor of the Army Air Corps was a special problem. Without any justification that Weston could see, he believed himself to be a professional military man on a level with Sergeant Everly. Taylor had been some sort of technician, something between a surveyor and a draftsman. Those skills were not very useful to Weston's weary would-be warriors. Weston could not leave Taylor behind to command the unit, because it was clear that neither the chief nor the remaining Marine would take orders from him, even if Taylor decided in his own best interests to assume command. The same consideration applied to sending Sergeant Taylor to lead the reconnaissance. He knew a little less, which was to say, almost nothing, about how to run a reconnaissance than Weston himself. And it was likely that if he got out of sight, and, as important, out of range of Weston's Springfield, he would decide that his best interests dictated taking off on his own and getting to Australia. At that point, Sergeant Everly returned, bringing with him not only everyone he had taken with him, but a Filipino. The Filipino was dressed in dirty, baggy, white cotton trousers and shirt, a U.S. Army campaign hat, and he was carrying an Enfield and a web belt slung around his neck. He looked, Weston thought, like a Mexican bandit.
"Where the hell have you been?" Weston greeted Everly.
"Look at this, Mr. Weston," Everly said, and handed him a sheet of paper.
It was a delinquent tax notice dated November 8, 1941, from the Misami Oriental Provincial Government to a farmer named Almendres Gerardo.
"What the hell?" Weston asked. "Turn it over, Mr. Weston," Everly said. Weston did so.
Office of the Commanding General, United States Forces in the Philippines, Mindanao Visayan Force in the Field, 1 October 1942. Proclamation. 1. By virtue of the power invested in me, the undersigned, as senior representative of the United States government and the Philippine Commonwealth, herewith assumes command. 2. A state of martial law is declared for the duration of the war. By order of the Commanding General, Wendell W. Fertig, Brigadier General, USA, commanding. Distribution. 1. To all commanding officers, USFIP. 2. To all provincial governors. 3. To all provincial officials. 4. To all Justice of the Peace Courts. 5. File.
What the hell is this? I found it nailed to a telephone pole. You think it's for real?
Everly pointed to the Mexican bandit.
He says he can take us there.
And you believe him? This thing isn't even printed, mimeographed. It's typed on the back of a tax due bill.
Our luck has got to turn sometime, Everly said. What have we got to lose?
2. Cagayan de Oro, Misami Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 12:25 hours, 10 October, 1942. The headquarters of the military governor of Mindanao had been established in the pre-war combined city hall of Cagayan de Oro and the provincial capital of Oriental Province.
It was a three-story, red-brick building of a vaguely colonial style, and it was relatively new, built from plans first drawn for the Works Progress Administration in the United States. The WPA was instituted during the early years of F.D. Roosevelt's presidency in the belief that government building projects, roads, post office buildings, etc., would provide employment for the unemployed and prime the pump of the depressed American economy. A Japanese flag, a red ball on a white background, flew from a flagpole mounted on top of the building, and the flags of the Imperial Japanese Army and the personal flag of a brigadier general in stands stood at either side of the main double-door entrance to the building. A slate-gray 1940 Lincoln V12 sedan came down what was still MacArthur, after the first General MacArthur, Boulevard, and pulled into one of the four reserved parking places in front of the building. Captain Matsuo Saikaku stepped out of the Lincoln and walked briskly up the shallow flight of stairs to the doors, returned the salute of the somewhat rumpled guard, and entered the building. Captain Saikaku was 24, and at nearly 6 feet and 180 pounds, he was somewhat larger than the average Japanese officer. He was wearing neatly starched and pressed khakis, a tie-less blouse and trousers, and well-shined shoes, rather than boots and puttees. A Sam Brown belt held a captured U.S. Army Model 1911 A1 Colt 45 ACP pistol in a U.S. Army holster. A large, highly polished chrysanthemum, symbol of Imperial Japan, was attached to the flap of the holster, almost entirely concealing the letters U.S. Captain Saikaku was less than pleased with the performance of the Lincoln. It ran roughly at slow speeds and often stalled, but he blamed such things more on the low-quality gasoline he had to use than any design failure of the car. Though Saikaku detested Americans, and most things American, he was willing to acknowledge they produced some fine products. In his view, the Colt was a much better weapon than the Japanese Nambu pistol, and they made the finest automobiles in the world. He considered the slate-gray V12 Lincoln to be one of the best. He clearly remembered his first encounter with a Lincoln V12 sedan. It was a 1939 model, but essentially identical to the one he had impressed for his official use from an official, now a detainee, of the First National Citibank of New York office in Cagayan de Oro. It was parked in front of the Foster Waikiki Beach Hotel in Honolulu, where Saikaku was employed as a gardener. His opinion then, and now, was that it was both pleasing aesthetically and a mechanical masterpiece. And, he believed, it was a car in keeping with his status. He would have to do something about the way it ran. He had been wondering if aviation gasoline, or a mixture of regular and aviation gasolines, would improve performance. But he was determined to keep the car. He was aware that Lieutenant Colonel Tange Kisho, who had impressed a Buick Super for his official use, was somewhat annoyed to learn that a Lincoln was a more prestigious car than a Buick Super. Lieutenant Colonel Tange was the senior of the 7 Kempe Tai officers attached to the office of the military governor of Mindanao and Captain Saikaku's superior officer. The Kempe Tai secret police was roughly the Japanese equivalent of the German Gestapo. Although members of the Kempe Tai were, in a sense, soldiers, as they came under the jurisdiction of the war ministry and bore military ranks, they were essentially autonomous and were not directly subordinate to the local military commander. Brigadier General Kurokawa Kenzo, the military governor, was chauffeured about in a 1940 Cadillac sedan Saikaku had impressed for him from an official of the Dole Pineapple Corporation. General Kenzo was pleased not only with his Cadillac, but with Captain Saikaku's thoughtfulness in finding it for him. It was not the sort of behavior General Kenzo expected from any Kempe Tai officer, and especially not from one he knew to be the son of the first cousin of General Tojo Hideki. Lieutenant Colonel Tange had come into the Kempe Tai from the Nagasaki Police Prefecture and was a reserve officer. Captain Saikaku believed that it didn't hurt at all to remind Lieutenant Colonel Tange that he himself was a regular officer of the Imperial Japanese Army, seconded to the Kempe Tai.